Lots of folks starting out in surgical critical care, such as new APPs or house staff or students in the SICU, are often confused because there are just so many types of procedures to understand. And if you don't know anything about it, then managing those post-ops and complications is really baffling. Over at the Intensive Care Academy, our other learning platform at ICU101.com, just dropped a new lesson for the SICU folks on thoracic surgery, managing the kind of bread and butter things you'll see there, like lung resections and esophagectomies. Check it out if you haven't. Big help for those of you in that world, ICU101.com. Otherwise, on to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Brandon, what's up?
We are back. We are minus a guest, and that means we're trying to get back to some of our good bread and buttery topics. And that means today a little bit of neuro action. So, you know, one of the more common things you're going to encounter in most neuro types of units, or maybe more general, smaller ICUs, depending on how specialized your center, is going to be the patient with intracranial hemorrhage. Often called either intraparenchymal hemorrhage, if it's in the brain, or intracerebral hemorrhage, depending on how you like to abbreviate things. But we want to get into the kind of general workflow and practical management of these people, because we've talked about this sort of patient in the past, and we focused, I think, on resuscitation and when it really progresses and becomes a bigger problem, people who are herniating, needing a lot of high-level therapies for their ICP. But that's not the majority of patients. Most of these patients are nothing. Most of the time, nothing happens. So, I mean, in our usual theme of, you know, focusing on practical matters, I think we should give some attention to that patient and just how you go about dealing with them on a day-to-day level. So, Brian, you are hanging in the neuro ICU, and then you hear about a patient who is a 73-year-old female. Mm-hmm. She has a history of AFib. She takes apixaban for that. She has some COPD. She's had a prior stroke, which was diagnosed some years ago, but has minimal deficits from that. But she came in with about 2 hours of what the spouse and the patient describe as lethargy and just some odd behaviors and a bit of headache and just sort of feeling not right. Mm-hmm. In the ED, she has a pretty non-focal exam, but again, the spouse thinks she's just not quite behaving like herself. They do a head CT, as you do, and there's about a 1 centimeter-ish intraparenchymal hemorrhage in the area of the left basal ganglia thalamus sort of area. It looks acute. There is no mass effect. And that is that.
Okay.
So let me ask you a few practical questions. In your center, who is usually going to get a call about this? Is the ED going to call neurosurgery, neurology, both? And then are they going to call you now, or is it going to depend on what those services recommend?
Yeah, so the way we have our setup, our neuro ICU is a closed unit, and our neuro ICU team is primary, but asterisk, we're not like the MICU. So the MICU admissions, the ED calls the MICU, and the MICU comes and sees the patient, admits the patient, blah, blah, blah. Neuro ICU, they call one of the neurology services, or one of the neurosciences services, I guess I should say. Usually that's stroke neurology, general neurology, or neurosurgery. And then they call us if the patient needs to come to the ICU. So for ICH, it kind of depends. I feel like, and I could be wrong, so if anybody's listening who knows better and wants to call me out, call me out next time you see me in the unit, I guess. But I feel like they call both neurosurgery and neurology, stroke neurology typically. And that's because if there is an operative component to it, i.e. the patient needs to go to the OR to get a washout or to get drained, or they need to have ICP monitoring put in or whatever, neurosurgery does that. If it's nothing but medical management, it's neurology. But a lot of times I think the ED decides not to make that decision. They decide to let the neuro teams kind of fight that out. So I think they call both. But in our center, typically if there is any sort of, and like you said, intracranial hemorrhage, ICH, intraparenchymal hemorrhage, IPH are virtually the same thing. it goes to stroke neurology unless there's a reason to go to the operating room. And so things like that might be a very large bleed that's causing ICP issues with a lot of shift, a lot of midline shift, or something like an epidural hematoma that's rapidly expanding and might need to get drained, or a large subdural, for example. Subarachnoid hemorrhages all go to neurosurgery, but just a good old ICH typically will go to neurology. And then they call us if the patient needs to come to the ICU.
Yeah. Yeah, so much of this really is about local practices. If it seems like it should be an obvious answer, I would suggest that what seems obvious is just how your center tends to do it. There are extremes, like the patient does or has a fair chance of needing an intervention, then neurosurgery should be involved. There's like absolutely no chance of that. Then maybe still neurosurgery, but that really depends on how you want to handle it. You just need somebody with kind of a neuro perspective. And especially if there's a lot of sort of medical considerations, like a complex medical background to the issue or things like that, then neurology certainly. A lot of places, both people will end up involved in some way, shape, or form, but it really just depends on how you want to handle things locally. Some places there is hardly any neurosurgery, or they're very sort of uninvolved because there's not a lot of coverage, and they only want to or can even hear about patients if there's something to do about it. It just depends. And I guess to circle back on definitions also, this confuses a lot of people, you know. An intraparenchymal hemorrhage is straightforward, bleeding in the brain. That is, by the way, technically a stroke, right? It's a hemorrhagic
stroke. It's a hemorrhagic stroke.
Yeah. So, and that is relevant definitions-wise because many places a stroke has some specific quality things that need to be done with them, even though generally we're talking more about ischemic strokes, but technically a hemorrhagic. Now, that's not a traumatic bleed. That may not technically be a stroke. We're talking about.
And this is sometimes really difficult to discern too, because
Maybe this was hemorrhagic. She didn't.
We have all the time people who come in because they had a fall, and then they have a head bleed, but it turns out they fell because they had a head bleed. Right? Yeah. It's not a traumatic head bleed. It's a hypertensive head bleed that then caused them to pass out for a minute. They fell, or they were in a car accident, but it turns out they had a aneurysm rupture that caused them to pass out, wreck their car. So their subarachnoid is aneurysmal, not traumatic. So sometimes it's a little difficult to tell just from the story if you're talking about a traumatic injury or a non-traumatic.
Yeah. Sometimes you can tell from the location some of the features, but yeah, it's tough. And then to call something an intracranial hemorrhage, it just means it's inside the skull. So that would technically include like a subdural or an epidural or things that are not in the brain per se, whereas if you called it an intracerebral hemorrhage, that would be in the cerebrum, the brain. Right. So people will get kind of loose with some of those terms, but a lot of places they'll tend to call it like an IPH or an ICH just by the kind of local acronym norms, but never neither is wrong.
ICH is almost like an umbrella term, right? Yeah. Especially if the C is cranial, right? Intracranial hemorrhage, well, technically would encompass subarachnoid hemorrhage as well, right? Because it's inside the cranium. But we treat those very differently. So technically, ICH is anything in the head. IPH is anything in the brain. And then you get into IVH, intraventricular hemorrhage. Right. And that'll be important when we talk about ICH as well, or IPH even, because it portends a slightly worse outcome.
Yeah. And I like to say IPH just to avoid any confusion about acronyms. But our center in neurosurgery is quite involved, so they see all these patients. Neurology usually will end up getting involved, but it's not as acutely maybe. Many times I think that's more important going forward as kind of, okay, in the ICU, maybe they don't have a lot to say, but as you get out to the floors, who's going to have continuity with the patient? Who's the floor team going to call if they have questions? Maybe neurosurgery is still involved, but at some point they start to kind of taper away and neurology may become their, the more continuity matter. But so in your case, do you bring all these patients to the ICU? Or is there some judgment maybe from one of those teams? Or do you have some strict criteria on which ones need the ICU?
We don't, that I know of, have any strict criteria. I think it's typically a judgment case. Now, I think some of this depends on when the patient's being admitted, to be honest, because I tend to see more low acuity ICHs admitted overnight. And I think part of that is because the coverage, neurology coverage at night is less. There's not an attending in-house. You know, there's usually a resident that covers both the floor and the ICU services. So whether it's because you have a resident who's like, I'm a little concerned and I don't, you know, have a good backup, so I don't know, so I just want to put everything in the ICU, or whether it's like, I'm kind of overwhelmed with stuff, and so if I could put this person in the ICU, I have some extra eyes to help me, and we can downgrade them in the morning. I don't really know, but that tends to be my experience. I don't think every ICH needs to come to the ICU. I think it depends on a couple of factors. One, obviously, is if there's other mitigating problems, right? So if you have a patient who is medically complex, and has an ICH, but has a lot of other medical problems that make them sick, right? They're shocky for some reason. Maybe they're septic, or they have, you know, uncontrollable high blood pressure that caused their bleed, and now they need to be in the ICU because they need something like a nicardipine infusion. Or if their level of consciousness is depressed enough that you have to intubate them, or that you're concerned that you're going to have to intubate them, those things all kind of come into play as well. One thing that you can sort we can sort of look at to determine like how bad the bleed is something called the ICH score. And the ICH score is made up of, I want to say, let's see, GCS, volume, location, interventricularness, age, like five components. And it's usually a zero or a one, except for a GCS gets used 0 to 2. And you add all those up and you get a score anywhere from 0 to 6, I think it is. And so an ICH of 0 is a pretty benign bleed. ICH 0 probably doesn't need to come to the ICU unless there's some other thing going on. All the way up to an ICH of 5 or 6 would definitely be bad. And that score can be used pretty reliably to prognosticate as well, because the higher you go up, the more your 30-day mortality increases, to the point that an ICH 5, I think, is like a 97% 30-day mortality off the top of my head. ICH 6 is 100%. Like in the studies, there's never been an ICH to survive more than 30 days. So that can kind of help you with prognostication. So if you don't have an ICH score already, those are things I like to ask, you know, when someone's calling me about an ICH to sort of determine that.
Yeah. We calculate the ICH score. Sometimes I'm not sure why. Is it just one of those things for the chart? And it is. I mean, it's something to put in the chart. And, you know, when we've spoken to Casey Albert in the past, she likes to caution using it prognostically because in the studies, you know, they were all open label. So presumably the right outcomes were somewhat affected by the scores. You know, the people who were treating these study patients knew what the score was. However, I like the idea of using it for dyspo because it does give you an idea just how bad and how likely there is to be a complication. We have not really had that practice, but we're pretty low threshold. Most of our bleeds come to the unit, but definitely the times when you can, I think, have more judgment is obviously if it's very small. I mean, you'll have these ones that are like a Ditzel. Not a lot of, you know, risk in your mind for worsening. You know, this patient was anticoagulated, so you're already kind of getting into things that you might worry about a little bit more. And then I think if you don't really think it's very acute, like a lot of what we're going to do is just watch and see if it gets worse. So if you have reason to think that time has already passed, it looks on imaging or maybe there was a traumatic event or something that was, you know, several days ago or a week ago. Hey, maybe you had prior imaging for some reason, you know, some reason to think this is not new. Then you can make a case. Maybe they don't need almost any care at all, or maybe they can have kind of a, we will sometimes see patients who can have like an interval scan in the ED. And then if it's stable, maybe they can not go to the ICU. That makes more sense than spending a very brief time in the unit. But I would say for us, the majority end up with us.
Yeah, and like you said, her anticoagulation status is something that I would consider that extenuating, right? So an ICH of, like I calculate, we didn't talk about where her GCS is, but I would calculate her, she's probably between a 1 and a 0, a 0 and a 1 ICH score. But the fact that she's anticoagulated makes me a little more concerned.
And I mean, the big picture we always have to bear in mind here is what's the point? What are we trying to do here?
Right.
We're trying to limit further growth of the bleed, and if it does occur, limit complications of it. There's nothing to do about the bleed itself, nor is there a reason you would need to, because this patient is basically more or less fine. I mean, very, you know, trivial symptoms. So you're just looking for worsening, and in most cases it won't happen. So you're playing kind of an odds game, looking for the relatively small number of patients, when we're talking about these more minor things, who are going to get worse, and trying to, you know, catch them early. So it's always a triage and resource sort of thing. I'm sure if you're in some, you know, low resource region with like one ICU bed, you would not take a patient like this to the ICU, because there's some actually sick patient who would much more benefit from it.
Right.
But, you know, in the typical American hospital, you know, with high medical legal concerns, enough beds for people, we see a lot of these patients.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say they say, oh, we're going to put the patient in the ICU. Your kind of general standard package of plans for a patient like this, what do you want their blood pressure to be?
So, you know, there's a little bit of disagreement about this. It used to be fairly straightforward. You'd say less than 160, systolic less than 160. Now I'm seeing people say less than 150 sometimes, less than 140 sometimes. So a little bit, there's a little bit of give according to whoever's sort of in charge of managing this. But I think less than 140, if there's concern for bleeding, is probably good. But anything kind of in that 140, 150, 160 range is probably okay. So a little bit of it is going to depend on who the patient is too, right? If you've got somebody who's chronically hypertensive and they're always 200, less than 140 may not be enough for them, right? They may start to have perfusion issues. You know, at the same time, if you've got somebody who is sort of just chronically hypertensive, just poorly controlled, and they kind of spike up here and there, then getting them under 140 is probably the best thing for them if they can tolerate it. So
the numbers have been here and there and everywhere. It's not like there hasn't been studies, because there have, but a lot of it depends on what study someone has read. And we've done a lot of under 140. We've done a little more liberal. Lately, the thing has been a lot of 130 to 150, because some of the recommendations are saying that. It makes a lot of sense to have a bit of a nuanced approach for the patient, depending on how high risk you think they are, and some, you know, the harms of more tight control and so on. But really, I think it typically ends up going to who feels the most strongly about it involved in the case, and you don't want to argue. Because if someone's like, oh, keep them under 150, and you're like, well, I think it can go to 160, but you're also pretty sure it's not going to hurt them to go under 150. You don't want to make this the hill you die on. I mean,
right.
And especially, you know, it's like any clinical dilemma. There's going to be some people who couldn't care less, some people who have like a weak opinion, and then, you know, maybe like one or two people with a really strong opinion. So unless you have two of those which are opposing who want to butt heads over it,
let's go.
I mean, surgeons may be involved. Surgeons often have strong opinions, not to dish on surgeons. So, you know, a lot of this comes down to like individual practice.
Yeah. And I think sometimes you have to say, like, how bad do you want this?
Yeah.
Right. So if you can get them really pretty well controlled at 150 or less with just some PRNs here and there, but you're not going to get them under 140 without putting them on a decently high dose of nicardipine. If that's the only thing, for example, that's going to make them go to the ICU, is it worth it? Right? If you say, well, I want them under 140. Well, they're 144, and I can't get them under 140 without putting them in a cardi, and then they have to come to the unit. If that's the only reason they come into the ICU, do they really need to be under 140, or can you go, okay, well, 144 is not so bad? Because let's be honest, what's a couple of points really make a difference, right? Now, if you get somebody who's very tenuous, and you say, no, I really want a 130, but I'll take 140. And you're like, well, it's 149. How's that? And they're like, that's not good enough. Okay, well, maybe you do need to bring them into the unit, put them on cardine, et cetera. But sometimes you just get to that where you go, well, in a perfect world, this is what I want, but what am I willing to tolerate?
Yeah. And there's no right answer for how much should you care. I mean, I guess the reasons I would care more is a bigger bleed, a more unstable patient who they're really kind of tenuous. Like if they have a small amount of hematoma growth, I think it may be a real problem. Sometimes they'll look at things like if you scan them, you know, a non-con head CT, and if they have a CTA as well, which I don't think you per se must have for a bleed like this, but many patients will because they're having just a stroke workup, and that's a pretty typical component of that now, looking for ischemic strokes. you can see some features that suggest more risk of growth. People talk about a spot sign, which is the appearance of contrast in the heart of the hematoma, meaning it's still actively bleeding. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just all blood that already occurred. These might be the reasons to think that, you know, this patient is at some additional risk. Or maybe you had a couple scans and it did grow. In that case, maybe you think, well, whatever we're doing wasn't enough.
Right, isn't enough.
Maybe we should be more aggressive, whether lowering your goal or just being more serious about it. So that's when you get into, you know, do we just use some PRNs to lower their pressure? Do you put them on a drip? Do you put in an A-line? I think the majority of our ICU patients like this, we will if you're doing anything. You know, if your goal is to give them under 150 and the whole time they've been 120, all right, whatever. But if, you know, if you're doing stuff, you have them on a drip, typically we'll put in an arterial line so that you can have that minute-to-minute monitoring.
Yeah. Yeah, I think especially if you're gonna put somebody on a drip, then you should probably just put an A-line in because, like you said, you're titrating it minute-to-minute. You should know minute-to-minute as opposed to getting a blood pressure cycled every hour.
And I think there's been data on that you can miss, you know, changes in pressure in between interval, you know, measurements, and maybe some of those can be associated with, you know, worsening outcomes. I think some patients are much more labile and that risk is more. Some of them seem like they have a pretty locked in pressure and you're probably not going to miss as much there. But
yeah, and then, you know, I mean, if you're cycling your blood pressure cuff more than once an hour, do you need an A-line? Maybe. I mean, you certainly shouldn't be cycling it like every 5 minutes continuously, right? That's something you should be doing for like, I'm getting ready to put a patient to sleep and put them on the ventilator, cycle the cuff every 2 minutes or every 5 minutes or something like that. But if you're doing it every 5 minutes, like all night long, put an A-line in.
Yeah. What about reversal of anticoagulation? So this patient takes a DOAC, a apixaban, which is, you know, might be the most common oral anticoagulant that we see out there these days. I mean, it used to be warfarin, and then mm-hmm. you kind of move into these newer drugs. What would you typically do for someone like this who's having an intracranial hemorrhage?
Yeah, so that's one of the first questions I ask about an ICH if they're on any kind of anticoagulation is, have they been reversed?
And we should say, if you're going to, it shouldn't wait for the ICU.
This is done by the ED. So, I mean, I think there's a good argument to be made for reversing everyone, although you should be cautious, right? Because this person's on apixaban for a reason. And if you reverse them, yes, you're helping with their bleed, but you're also going to undo whatever therapeutic benefit that they were put on it for the first place. Now, I think when in doubt, just reverse, because the reversal is eventually going to wear off. And, you know, the idea behind anticoagulation reversal is I'm not just reversing you, but I'm stopping your anticoagulation. So you're not going to get another dose of apixaban. So when I reverse you, it's going to undo what's in your system. But if I give you another dose, it's going to come right back. Right. And that's what's really great about the DOACs too. So if you reverse somebody and then decide, oh, they don't really need to be reversed, and I'm more concerned about thrombosis, then just start their apixaban back or put them on heparin or something like that. So I tend to err on the side of they should probably be reversed. And again, I guess it kind of depends. If you've got somebody that's got a very stable, very small bleed, they might not need to be. But often these are time-sensitive decisions and you may not know enough yet to know if you should reverse or not. So.
Yeah, I would say the majority of intracranial hemorrhages on a DOAC should be reversed. If you're not too worried, the way that you show that is you resume it sooner rather than later. And like you said, you can ask what the countervailing risk is. AFib, the risk is stroke from their AFib. And that's a risk that accumulates over time. The risk of being off anticoagulation for a few days, very trivial. I mean, we're not talking about years here, which is how they usually measure risk, some handful of percent per year. What does that mean for a few days? Very little. You know, the more risk would be someone with like some serious hypercoagulable state, you know, disposing them to things like PEs or, I don't know, antiphospholipid syndrome or something. You know, like someone who was recently anticoagulated for a big PE or something. Then you wouldn't love having them off for very long. Right. But still, the greatest risk of hematoma growth is going to be in this first few hours to days. Yeah. And in most cases, the risk of being on something is going to be more than the risk of being off for that period of time. So yeah, I think in most cases you do. Because like you said, in 12 hours, the patient gets much worse and you wish you had reversed them. You know, it's right. too late
it's
now.
It's too late to do anything. Well, and I think, you know, not to be cavalier about stuff, but I, you know, I like to remind people that there's virtually nothing we do in the ICU that can't be undone in either direction, right? So if you're going to err on the side of doing or not doing, then well, probably just do. And then you can undo it if that turns out to be the wrong decision. And like you said, in a case like this, the stakes of doing something are lower than the stakes of not, right? Because if I reverse you, the odds are you're not going to have anything happen in the next several hours. But if I don't reverse you, the odds of you getting a bleed that's worse are probably not necessarily that high, but the stakes are. Yeah, so if the bleed gets worse, the risk of the bleed getting worse in terms of odds is still low. Right, the odds are, but if it does, it can cause serious damage. So I think in that case, you're probably better off reversing.
Yeah, and not to dwell on the point, but again, that applies to most of these patients because most of them are going to be fine anyway. The number of people who are moving the needle at all is relatively small, but the stakes can be quite high for them. Yes. I'm just going to make up numbers like. Maybe 1% of patients like this have significant, you know, worsening of their bleed, growth in their hemorrhage. And maybe, you know, 10% of those is it's really important. Like they really become sick and they, you know, herniate and get intubated and stuff like that. That's a tiny number, but that's a very sick patient and that perhaps one that was avoidable. Now, if they were a little worse, those numbers were a little higher and so on. But so, you know, if these considerations are feeling a little bit theoretical, that's for a reason, but they're also not theoretical. They're just low probability, and which are not the same thing right. if you're the patient who it happened to. So,
right. Yeah. And I think I read that apixaban, I think, is the number one most prescribed drug in the United States now.
Yeah. At some point, we...
So this is something you definitely need to ask every patient who comes in, because there's a good chance they're on it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was apixaban or rivaroxaban, and at some point, people ever started to lean toward apixaban. I think there was some study that the medicine people know about that I don't know, but this is mostly what we're seeing now. But
yeah.
Reversal, for the most part, is four-factor PCCs, prothrombin complex concentrates, factors 10, 7, 9, and 2, to try to kind of overwhelm the blockade. It is not a complete direct reversal. That was achieved through the drug andexanet alpha, which was controversial and then is no longer a drug. pulled from the market.
And even when it was, there was a lot of debate over whether it really worked or not.
It wasn't clear how well it worked. Maybe it was a little bit, prothrombotic, and it was certainly very expensive. So a lot of places didn't carry it anyway. They weren't on board, and now there is no board to be on.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much Kcentra is the trade name in the States here, four-factor PCCs. If you do encounter dabigatran, Pradaxa, which is sort of the original, NOAC or DOAC, there is Praxbind, itarucizumab, which is a direct reversal agent, but that drug too has really kind of lost favor.
Yeah, I don't feel like I ever really see that anymore. It's almost always apixaban and rivaroxaban. Which
it's like by the time everyone got on board with this class of drugs, we'd already moved on.
Yeah, now I do remember that was a big one for a while when it first came out, and then when itarucizumab came out, that was a huge step forward because a lot of people were just terrified of that not being able to reverse it.
Yeah. Which is, it's funny. We used to teach that a benefit of being on warfarin is that you actually can reverse it, whereas these drugs, not entirely. But we've kind of just gone away because warfarin's such a pain in the butt. And then you're just more likely to need to reverse it because people were all super therapeutic all the time.
Whereas it turns out it's not such a big deal.
Yeah. Now, the other reversal situation we'll encounter sometimes is antiplatelet drugs. And this is not, I guess, this case, but to briefly touch on, it's much less clear what to do when someone comes in on aspirin or clopidogrel or something like that. You can reverse it by transfusing platelets. You can take a middle ground of a bit and give them DDAVP, which restores some of the platelet function. But it's really unclear. How do you guys tend to handle that?
It sort of depends. I don't think we we'll probably give some platelets, but you know, we're not like getting really aggressive. Like we're not like getting a tag or anything like that, which is really what you need, right? It's because platelet count gives you no help. You need to know, you know, platelet activity. So you're going to need something like, you know, an MA on a tag or something like that. And I don't think we're doing that, but, you know, that brings up another issue though, that is a good question to ask is why are they on antiplatelets? And if they're, especially if they're on dual antiplatelets, like clopidogrel or, ticagrelor, and aspirin, then you probably have a little bit more risk because people that are on dual antiplatelets are probably on it because they've had a fairly recent stent placed. And so, you know, especially a cardiac stent, the more recent that stent was placed, the more likely you're going to get in-stent thrombosis. So you really sort of need to be concerned about, is it necessary to reverse this? Is it necessary to hold this? Because you're potentially risking an MI. And so then you get into, you know, like we were talking about before with the risk of a clot from AFib causing a stroke being pretty low for a short period of time. But the risk of a clot in in-stent thrombosis and a fresh cardiac stent is higher. It's still not, you know, 90% or anything, but I think it's something to really take into consideration before you talk about messing with antiplatelets.
Yeah, both the benefit and the risk are not as good here. You're probably not as prone to more bleeding from most of these drugs, maybe short of the most potent anticoagulant or antiplatelet meds. And like you said, the risk may be higher. I mean, the PATCH trial was the most notable work in that area, which was platelet transfusion for spontaneous bleeds, more or less like this. And not only did it not seem like it helped, it seemed like it actually worsened their outcomes. So I think a case like this is like the most clear example of when not to do it. Now you can give them DDAVP or something that I don't think that's even been studied. Now a traumatic bleed like this, that wasn't part of PATCH, so it's a little less clear. But this is another realm where people can really argue it out. And then you're like, well, this particular patient's different. Oh, but their hematoma got worse and so on and so forth. But okay, usually we're going to scan them again. This is a big part of, you know, evaluating whether they're getting worse or not, which of course is the whole thing we're trying to avoid. When are you going to scan them?
Probably 6 hours after their initial scan.
6 hours, pretty sort of standard for this type of bleed. I've seen shorter and I've seen longer in some cases. Some people who really seem sick, they'll do a little shorter. And most time it'll be six, but sometimes it can be flexible. Like, our neurosurgery service often likes people to have morning CTs, you know, do it in the mornings, they can see it in the morning. So then if you're, depending on the timing, should you do it exactly 6 hours? Or like, let's say they come in at, you know, 3 a.m. Should we just do it, you know, at 5 a.m. so that can have that, versus like waiting for the next, that kind of business? Or we're talking about if someone's going to have like an MRI, can that count as one of these?
As their scan. Like,
stability their scans. Yeah. Six is pretty common.
Yeah, and I think it's, again, we need to remember that there's nothing magic about these numbers. A lot of times, we pick these numbers just sort of out of the air because they're convenient. Sometimes they're based on studies. But who's to say that six is any better than seven? Because that probably wasn't tested, right? It was probably looked at, and I don't know, I'm just making this up. But if there's a study out there that shows six is the best time, it was probably something like 6 versus 12 or 6 versus 24, which is a pretty big discrepancy. So yeah, if for convenience sake, like you said, if you've got somebody who comes in at, you know, midnight and you get your AM scans at 5, should you get it at 6? No, it's fine. Just get it at 5, right? That's probably fine.
Yeah.
If you've got somebody who's getting a scan anyway of something else, right? For some reason they're going to have a you have concern you're going to get a chest CT and it's been, you know, 8 hours since your last head CT. Should you just go ahead and get the head CT with that? Sure, it's probably fine.
Yeah. I mean, what we're saying with six-ish hours is you want to give enough time to see if there was growth, but not so long that if you did, you don't notice it for like a day. And
right. Like an hour is probably too short.
Yeah.
Because
if it grew a lot in an hour, you'd probably have noticed clinically.
Right. I was going to say, if you've got enough bleeding that you've got some sort of change on your imaging in an hour, you have other signs, right?
Yeah.
Like you said, the idea is 6 hours is long enough for something to change without big symptom changes, but also not so long that we've let it go to the point that you're like, oh my gosh, this is horrible.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a good point to make. I mean, what we're really saying, it's like when you see your PCP and they say come back in a year or sooner if you need. It's 6 hours, but if something changes, like the patient deteriorates,
yeah, you're not going to go, well, it's not time for sooner. Scan yet, right? So.
Yeah, the whole point is if they get worse, you want to see. And that's the other important part of monitoring, right? Clinical monitoring.
Yeah.
You're going to do, quote, neuro checks, usually hourly.
Yeah.
It's kind of the general standard. And that's largely what people come to the ICU for, because we can do things hourly, which you usually can't do anywhere else. And, I mean, what do your neuro checks look like in your ICU for a patient like this?
So what we say, and I assume this is what gets done, right, is that they should be getting a full GCS. Can you answer all the questions? Can you move everything? Strength equal, et cetera. At least in the short term, initially, they should be getting NIH stroke scales done repeatedly, we'll just say. I don't know that you need them every hour, right? So I think we say sometimes with frequent NIH or serial NIH, I don't know that you need them every hour, but something approaching that, even if it's just a quick, can you hold up your arms in front of me and check for pronator drift? Can you move everything equally? That sort of thing. I don't know that you need to do the whole, mama 50-50 tip top, touch your nose, touch my finger, touch your nose, touch my finger, slide your foot down your shin, etc. But something approaching that, right? Because you do want to see, because like you said at the beginning, this is a stroke. And so you want to see, is the stroke getting worse? And the NIH stroke scale is the way we sort of quantify that. So
yeah, yeah. And like I said, there are quality metrics associated with some of this. And I think, frankly, these just get lumped in with how we treat ischemic strokes, where you are supposed to do the NIH stroke scale for your monitoring. And because it's technically a stroke, that sort of applies here too. Even though realistically, if these get worse, it's usually not in some super focal, localized way. Like now all of a sudden they have like ataxia of their like left toe or something like that, which is kind of what the NIH scale is meant to appreciate. Usually when bleeds get worse, it's in a pretty diffuse way. They get sleepier. They get more altered. They blow a pupil, something like that. And neurochecks for that is mostly, I mean, I joke, it's kind of just poking them with a stick and making sure they're still alive. It's kind of in that realm. And a lot of it is somewhat subjective. The nurse knows the patient well, and they're like, they've changed.
Right.
But yes, technically, at least some, if not all, of these neurochecks should probably be NIHs for the ICU purposes.
Yeah.
What about MRIs? Is this something you'll do on all patients like this or some?
Yeah, so this in our place the decision usually falls to neurology, but we do typically do MRIs unless sometimes neurology will say, I don't need an MRI. This I have enough information. But a lot of times MRI will help if the cause of the bleed is unclear, right? So is this just a hypertensive bleed or is there something else going on? Is the CAA, we were just talking about the other day, one of my attendings mentioned, he said, I think I've seen CAA once or twice in my career and we talk about it every day here. We do have for whatever reason, we tend to have a larger population of that. Is there some sort of venous malformation, arterial malformation, et cetera? So sometimes MRI can be helpful in kind of drilling down those diagnoses if it's not readily apparent. Now, if it's readily apparent, sometimes they'll say, we don't need the MRI. I feel like we typically get them anyway, unless it becomes a hassle, right? Like it's taking a couple of days to get the MRI and neurology might go, well, that's fine. I don't really need it. So we can cancel it. But if I can get it really easily, sure, let's just get it.
Yeah, the MRI is, well, it's for two things. One is because neurology especially likes MRIs. Yeah. They're never going to be like, no, whatever you do, no MRI for me. Right. It's like our, well, I don't know what our equivalent is, like an echo or something. You know?
Yeah, I was going to say a bedside echo.
It just lets them really see the brain and the pathology in great detail, and you know they can put it in their next slide set. But the practical reason is to ask why this bleed happened, right? Yeah. And the majority are from hypertension, which is, you know, partly why a lot of these people need their blood pressure controlled when they come in. Anticoagulation, of course, contributes. And then among the rest, a lot of them have some anatomic substrate for it, which like a vascular malformation, a tumor malignancy. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that not only is a non-con CT not a very good test for a lot of these things to really see the tissue, CTA helps now that we're doing a lot of those for these vascular things, but still, the blood itself often kind of obscures what you're looking
right.
at. Because it can have a similar density to some of these other things. It's kind of covering the area. It's kind of like when they do like an EGD, they look in your stomach for GI bleeding, and they can't find the source of bleeding because of all the blood.
Right.
And they're like, or, you know, they think they found it, but they're like, oh, I'm going to scope you again in a month or two once this is cleared up to get a clearer picture to make sure there's not something else underlying there, like tumor or something. So that's what the MRI is for. It's to distinguish the blood from something that might have been causing the blood, which is not usually actionable, like, urgently or emergently. That's why it's not like you have to rush them to MRI in the first day. It's, at worst, academic, and at best, something for down the road when someone starts talking about, oh, we need to work you up for this mass, or, oh, we need to think about your vascular anomaly and maybe we'll work that up more. Maybe you'll have a DSA, a catheter angiogram, to see this better, and maybe we're going to intervene, like to coil something. Maybe you'll need surgery. Or these kind of in-betweeny things like CAA, cerebral amyloid angiopathy, which is, you know, an amyloid disorder, which is often of somewhat academic interest. But so where you fall in there will depend. And many times we do, by the way, MRI, you're going to want with contrast. That's the best way of appreciating these things like tumors and so on.
Yeah. And I think this brings up a good point because it's something I think as ICU people, we sometimes forget about because for better or for worse, I think most ICU providers have a very similar mentality to emergency medicine providers in that I'm here to treat the initial problem in front of me. And you really do want to know, like, why did the patient bleed? Why did they have a stroke? Because it's more than it doesn't really help you so much right now, right? I don't care why, I'm going to treat them the same. Sure, but they probably care because they want to prevent it from happening again. And so we do a lot of things with ischemic stroke workups too, that initially the ICU provider might go, I don't really understand why we're doing that because it doesn't change my management. Sure, it doesn't change your management, but it may help us discover why it happened in the first place so we can prevent it from happening again.
Yeah. And frankly, even when there is not something to, you know, reduce further risk, by and large, people want to know.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think there's some value to that too. It's just, instead of just saying, well, we don't know.
Shit happens. Yeah. Which essentially, yeah. I mean, these things happen all of a sudden. It really comes out of nowhere for most people. And to be able to give them some amount of explanation, it can be valuable.
Even if it's not something, like you said, that can be prevented in the future, right? Just think how unnerving that would be to just be like, why did I spontaneously bleed into my brain and have to be in the ICU? No clue.
Yeah. And
so it can happen again at any time? I guess.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, like,
well, and what also comes into play in a case like this, there is one clearly modifiable risk, which is anticoagulation.
Right.
We've held it. We probably reversed it. If and when they should get back on anticoagulation is going to be a tough question now. And maybe the cause of it will bear into that.
Yes.
So, I mean, who usually makes this decision for you guys?
I think neurology usually is the ones to sort of make this ultimate decision in concert with the ICU team and in concert sometimes with whoever put them on the anticoagulation to begin with. It depends on why they're on it, right? If they're on it for a very common reason like AFib, stroke prophylaxis. Neurology feels very comfortable with that. If they're on it for some sort of obscure reason that they don't deal with very often, that may be related to, I don't know, like oncology or some other more esoteric specialty, then we probably will curbside or consult them to say, hey, what's the help us with the risk benefit ratio here of restarting this anticoagulation?
Yeah. Because it really may involve, you know, the risk and benefit are like each belongs to a different specialty. So they really need to have a head to head to figure out how to go about this. The most common practice I'll usually encounter for this kind of thing when it's not really cut and dry is we'll start them back on something that's shorter acting, like usually a heparin infusion. Mm-hmm. Usually no initial bolus, just gradually let them come up to a therapeutic range and then scan their head again. You know, maybe right away, maybe you give them, oh, once they're therapeutic, wait, whatever, 6 hours or something.
6 hours, yeah.
Yeah, and then see if they had any growth or worsening. And just about as a rule, they never do because this is such a gentle challenge. I mean, that doesn't mean they're not going to bleed again in a week. I mean, you're just saying like initially, do they seem to tolerate this? And then after some period of time, when you're convinced they're okay, you can transition them back to something longer acting like their oral drug. I don't know how much risk this approach actually, you know, reduces, but it's a more thoughtful kind of gradual stage way to go about it than just being like, I'm sure you're fine. Take this giant handful of anticoagulants and get out of here. And that's often what we'll see. But the amount of waiting is usually, I mean, at least day, often in time we'll talk about like a week or something like that.
Yeah.
Again, depending on how much risk.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we'd say, you know, if the risk is low and they don't have any other issues, if we don't want to keep them for a week, if that's all that's going to hold them in the hospital. But yeah, I think you're right. Usually at least 24 hours, but up to several days beyond that, depending on things.
Yeah. And there is judgment here, although there's some data too, I think. And sometimes maybe someone never goes back on. If that's where, you know, the risk benefit falls, maybe they were on it for some kind of, you know, borderline reason. Oh, they were treated for a PE, but they didn't really need to still be on it. They were just
I was gonna say, especially if they were on it for some sort of time limited reason, like you said, DVT treatment or PE treatment, and you're supposed to do it for 3 months or 6 months and you're at 4 months, 5 months, right? Maybe we just don't go back.
Yeah. And well, I mean, we'll see traumatically too, people who are, you know, older person, they fell, hit their head. You can really ask now, should they go back on this? Because maybe it happens again. Maybe it has. Maybe they've had multiple falls.
Right.
And that risk benefit is really starting to shift. Oh yeah, they still have AFib. I mean, that risk is fixed, but now the risk of being on it has become higher and higher and higher. These can be kind of shared decision-making processes sometimes because people might say, I'm more worried or scared of having a stroke than of, you know, a bleed or the other way around. Mm-hmm. And, you know, long-term, generally, I would say generally, at least for us, neurosurgery will follow up with these people, like in clinic. And sometimes these decisions can happen then, right? We're going to decide later. We'll get another scan, you know, whatever it is, a month or a couple months. And, you know, maybe that's when you'll get back on something. And, you know, in an ongoing fashion, keep making the decision. But this will not necessarily be resolved in the hospital either.
Right, right.
How long do you usually keep these people in the ICU?
Just depends. I mean, I think, like I said, if you've got somebody, we will, not infrequently, I'll say, you have these people with an ICH of 0 or 1 admitted overnight just because people were nervous. And then in the morning, they've not required any cardine. They've required, you know, 1 or 2 doses of PRNs for blood pressure. Their neuro exam is good. Their 6-hour CT is stable. They can probably go out. You know, again, presuming they don't have any other things that would keep them in the ICU. If you've got somebody who has a little bit bigger bleed, sometimes we'll keep people for, you know, we don't like to keep people in the ICU just to watch them, right? I always often joke that this is the intensive care unit. And if I'm not caring for you, then this isn't the intensive watching unit. But it depends.
I know for like neuro patients, it often is.
It kind of is. Yeah. And so if you've got somebody, for example, who's on hemicrany watch, right? Because you're concerned, they have a pretty big bleed, or an ischemic stroke that has some hemorrhagic inversion to it. And they have a large penumbra of stroke. You know, you're concerned about swelling. You're concerned about they might need to go get part of their bone flap taken off for ICP or whatever. Then you would keep them. But, you know, it kind of gets into that judgment, clinical judgment range of, you know, when can they leave? And a lot of times, like I said, if their bleed is stable, their CT scans have been fine, their vitals are stable, they're not requiring any intensive care interventions, then they can usually go out. And again, your mileage will vary depending on where you are. A lot of places, if you have a really robust neuro step down unit where the nurses are going to be able to have, you know, 3 to 4 patients apiece, and they can probably do Q2 interventions, then you might have a little bit lower threshold to move somebody out, versus if they're going to go to a place where the nurses have 5 or 6 patients and they're only going to get Q4 or Q6 interventions, right? So you have somebody who's maybe, they don't really need to be in the ICU, but they're a little tenuous, but I know that if they go to the PCU or the step down, they're going to be watched closely enough that we're going to catch stuff, and that's fine. Or you might say, I don't know, they're kind of on the fence and I want to keep them in the ICU just to make sure.
Yeah. Ultimately, it usually comes down to how often can you do neuro checks. If they need it hourly, it's the ICU. If they can do it at you know, most every 4 hours, they can usually go to some kind of floor. And if you have some kind of in-between-y step-down unit, they can often do every couple hours. So who, you know, what's the difference between Q2 and 4 or whatever? That for sure is a judgment call. I mean, you're like, oh, no, this patient will fail within 3 hours, but not with, you know, like...
Yeah, and sometimes we'll have situations where, you know, the service will say, you know, I'm kind of concerned about their level of consciousness and their ability to protect their airway. And we'll go, well, I mean, they're protecting their airway right now. And the nice thing is our neuro PCU is just next door. And so if they start to have respiratory issues, we can just very easily walk across the hall and intubate somebody and bring them back to the unit. Versus if you're in a situation where they're going to go to a different floor or maybe even a different building, where if somebody was tenuous, it's going to be more difficult to get them the help they need. So again, kind of a judgment call. So if you're in a place where the ICU is immediately available, then you could probably move people out that are a little bit more on the fence, because moving them back or at least getting an intensivist to come and take care of them is easy.
The other time when we'll, you know, you might be more likely to hold on to someone for nothing more than watching, as you said, is if you're worried about something like edema, which, you know, in a small spontaneous bleed like this, there's not usually a great deal of edema, but it's something really big, or especially with trauma. And then when you get into, you know, like an ischemic stroke that has bleeding, had conversion, there's kind of a lot of overlap in pathologies here. But the problem with edema is that it can be kind of delayed. So the fact that someone is stable for initial period like this doesn't mean that they won't continue to have worsening of edema and maybe progress into something like herniation. If there is already, you know, like a big injury, maybe already some edema, and if they were to have more swelling, that could cause them to herniate. Those are people that you might want to watch in the ICU for days, because, you know, when you are at your peak of swelling, it is not going to be until days have passed. And those can be kind of a pain in the neck, because they really may be fine. But those are times when you may just wait for a certain amount of days to pass.
Yeah, a lot of people in the neuro ICU, I kind of warn them up front. If they're very stable and normal acting with a neuro exam, you know, you're in for a pretty boring couple of days, because you're going to hang out with us. Yeah, ideally, hopefully, right? And we see this with subarachnoid hemorrhages a lot too. That sometimes those folks will stay 3 weeks in the ICU because of vasospasm risk, even though they are a 15 GCS on room air, and they're just laying in bed watching TV and
getting woken up every hour.
Yeah, and I'm like, so this is the worst hotel you've ever stayed in, right? You can't get out of bed. People wake you up all the time, and you just watch pay-per-view. Stupid vacation.
But again, we're looking for that minority of people who get catastrophically worse. I mean, if you're going to ask about, you know, how much each dollar of healthcare spending here is getting us, it's not a lot. I mean, spoiler alert. Yeah. But that's the nature of neurocritical care, because once a lot of this happens, you can't undo it. So we're trying to prevent the problems. You know, the other time when you may really think they benefit from the ICU is if there is a factor like they seem to be dependent on a certain blood pressure. You know, they really are reliant on, you know, perfusing their brain to have a certain pressure head behind it, which, you know, sometimes is more for ischemic strokes, but we can see this with bleeds. And that can be a very what's the word? Effervescent, evanescent, ephemeral thing to, because they can be totally dependent on where their vitals and even their position and things like that is at a particular moment. And if you really think that they're going to underperfuse part of their brain if their blood pressure dips, then that's the kind of monitoring you need to do in the ICU.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just, that's so far from what they can do anywhere else that that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Where will you usually transfer these patients to? I mean, where to the floors, but under what service?
So it sort of depends. Again, the way our model works, we're a closed unit, but we sort of unofficially, I guess, co-manage these people. So, you know, if neurology admits them, but they want to put them in the ICU, they transfer them to us, but they continue to follow them. And so they usually just go back to neurology. Same thing with neurosurgery. Typically, though, with a bleed like this, unless they've had a surgical intervention, by the time they leave the ICU, even if neurosurgery's been following them in the ICU, they're going to go to neurology.
Lost interest. Yeah.
Yeah, because at that point, the neurosurgeons are like, well, we're not really doing anything. We'll follow, but we're not managing anything. And again, I think it still matters what else is going on. We do have the odd patient who has a very minor bleed, but they are more or less over that. They still need to be in the hospital for a little bit of monitoring, but they also have COPD exacerbation or renal failure or other medical issues that are really more important at this point. So occasionally we will see these patients transferred to hospital medicine, and neurology just will consult and follow for their, strange as it sounds, less significant head bleed than their other issues. So again, I can think it kind of depends on the patient. But all things being equal, most of the time, you're going to go to neurology.
Yeah. This, too, is purely a workflow thing. There is no right answer.
Yeah.
A lot of it depends on your center and how they handle coverage. The biggest centers will have inpatient services for everything from dermatology to ophthalmology, and then you're more likely to keep patients on that specialty service. Smaller centers, it may just be like, you know, medicine and general surgery or something. Mm-hmm. We usually send these patients to medicine, to the hospitalists, and then one or both of those consulting brain services will keep following and provide that kind of ongoing care. And, you know, by and large, the hospitalists, I think, will just do whatever they want, you know, with regards to the brain issues. And then if there's anything else going on, they'll take care of that. Sometimes neurosurgery will take their own, but these small things, they're not usually real interested in. We don't have an inpatient neurology service right now. Otherwise, I'm sure they would take some of these. But it really is just what makes sense to everyone. I think what's important is that people are going to want, again, at least one of these specialty services to be involved so that they don't just have to make some of these decisions themselves, especially if there are some important ones pending, like what are we doing with anticoagulation? And frankly, by the time they leave the ICU, when can this patient go home? Because by that time, there's often not much more going on.
Right.
It may just be a matter of how much more lower level monitoring does this person need before they can leave.
Yeah, or things like, you know, we're still trying to work out the cause, right? So we're waiting on MRI or whatever, or especially like some of these, you know, like I said, they come in at 11 o'clock, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and then a morning round, so like, we can downgrade this patient. They probably haven't had an MRI yet. They probably haven't had an echo yet. They probably haven't had any of those sort of why did this happen tests. So they might be technically okay to go home, right? But we don't really know what happened, so they got to stay.
Yeah. And in general, I mean, these small, you know, minimal deficit, you know, physically not large bleeds, by the time they're ready to leave the ICU, there is not too much more. So be thinking already about what barriers there are to them going home, because it's not like they're going to have a long stay on the floors either. You need to tie up these issues. Yes, I mean, you're going to watch them a little more, but it's not going to be for another week. So try to kind of get these things situated. You have your, whatever, case managers involved. If they need some PT, and figure out where they're, and so on and so forth, because it's not like it's going to be days from now.
Right.
Okay. What else should we say about this?
I don't know. I mean, I think ICH is an interesting case, and they can run the gamut from being a big bunch of nothing to, you know, extremely sick. You know, I've had ICHs that come in before that, you know, need intervention, intubation in the field, and they have profound deficits, and, you know, it quickly becomes a goals of care talk because the the injury is so devastating, all the way down to, like you said, that you go, I'm squinting to see on the CT scan, is that even blood? Are we sure this is a bleed? And they really have no symptoms other than they had a headache. And when they got a CT scan, somebody was like, bleed. And so I think it's a weird diagnosis in that regard, and that it can be something so minor and trivial all the way up to devastating.
Yeah. And I think it is the perfect illustration of the way neurocritical care can be, or at least how it can feel, and almost the stereotype of it, where a lot of the time we're doing nothing. People are fine. And then sometime the patients are horribly messed up. And even then, a lot of the time we're doing nothing. It kind of feels like their outcome is more fated, and we're just, you know, bearing witness to it. But, you know, there is this slice of patients where you can affect their outcome by preventing some deterioration. Catch it early, reduce their risk, and prevent things from getting worse. And even if that's not a high number of percents, the outcomes can be so devastating that you may still be reducing a lot of badness in the world. So I like you said, I do warn patients. It's going to feel like a lot of what we're doing is just watching, because that is the case. And ideally, it'll just be boring and nothing will happen. If something happens, we're here to try to catch it pretty early. But a lot of what we're doing is literally just bothering you frequently and making sure that you're okay. So if people are like wondering why more is not happening, I'm like, that's actually by design. That's the, the nature of the
beast. That's best case scenario in the neuro ICU is that.
Yeah. You don't want us doing stuff. Yeah, you don't. If people are doing stuff to you in the neuro ICU, things have gone wrong.
Yeah.
Well, that's a nice look at this topic. Again, if you work in a neuro unit, this is like maybe one of the most common types of patients that you see. And they're everywhere out there, including in the ER and in other flavors of ICU too. So important thing to understand in critical care in general. We'll just remind you guys, this is only our own takes on this and some general education. No advice for you, and we're not representing our own institutions. Just our own brains, which are hopefully blood-free. Talk to you soon.
Well, at least blood in the wrong place is free.